You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a Wisconsin garage band that's been playing around the state and beyond since 1965. First, scientists in China have cloned two baby monkeys using somatic cell nuclear transfer. That's the same method that gave us Dolly the sheep over 20 years ago. It's the first time primates have been cloned using that process, and it could open the door to new types of disease research. But the scope of that research could be limited by ethical concerns, and it doesn't necessarily mean that human clones are any closer to becoming a reality. Dina Fine-Marin is the health and medicine editor at Scientific American. Executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked with her earlier this week.
Scientists have been able to clone primates using other methods in the past. Why is using this particular type of cloning such a big step?
Great question. Yeah, so the cloning technique they use this time around, called somatic cell nuclear transfer, is exciting for really two reasons. The first one is that they're hoping that in the future they could couple this with the gene editing technology CRISPR for future research on specific diseases or genetic mutations. This will be able to be used in a way to alter cells earlier in the process, so they would be able to avoid a phenomenon called mosaicism, wherein maybe some of the cells that they altered weren't completely changed, and so not everything is uniform across the board. They're hoping that in the future they could do research with monkeys like these to see if they have a uniform population. They could see, for example, how drugs affect monkeys with a certain type of mutation.
How does cloning non-human primates compare in difficulty to cloning other mammals?
For reasons the researchers weren't really sure about, it seems to have been much harder. This same method was done with Dolly the sheep 20 years ago, and since then it's been done on more than 20 other species, including pigs. But when researchers previously tried using this Dolly approach on monkeys, it did produce fetuses, but no pregnancy that lasted beyond 80 days. And the main obstacle, the Chinese research team believes, was likely that the transferred nuclei were not properly reprogrammed to support embryonic development. So the researchers this time around tried something new. They deployed two critical enzymes that removed the gene's memory of being somatic cells, or the cells that make up tissues and organs, and that seemed to allow this process to proceed forward.
And so they're taking these cells from fetuses, not from adult monkeys.
Exactly. So what they did here was they took aborted monkey fetuses, were able to take cells from that and move forward with the cloning process using those. In this process called somatic cell nuclear transfer, they essentially swap the nucleus of one of these donor cells, so the fetal cell, into a fertilized egg that's been purged of all its own DNA. And then that egg will contain an exact copy of the donor's genome. And then if it's implanted into a surrogate mother, the eventual offspring will be that clone.
Dina, you mentioned one of the benefits of this could be drug testing. Are there other types of research that could benefit human health specifically that could come about with having access to these cloned monkeys?
There's a lot of excitement about doing various testing for various diseases. One of the things that researchers mentioned to me was looking at how environmental factors might affect disease risk. So you'd have this population that would be genetically uniform. You could expose it to certain things that, let's say, humans might see in their environment and see what diseases that leads to or doesn't lead to. So that's something they're really excited about.
I think I also read that they're looking at this as possibly a way to do further investigation on Alzheimer's specifically. Why would that be?
Well, I think that's a little hard to say at this point. One of the reasons they would be excited about Alzheimer's disease is, as many of us know right now, we can't really confirm Alzheimer's disease until a person is dead and we analyze the brain. That's obviously not a good time to be getting our answers. So I assume that they would look at populations that have certain genetic mutations that seem to put people at increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease and see how different drugs or environmental factors might affect them. But I'm not entirely sure.
We've been talking about how humans might benefit, but actually endangered species could theoretically benefit from this new technology as well. How would that work?
Well, one of the areas that people are excited about is something that would require several more steps of advancement. The idea would be if there's a population that was mostly wiped out, you could find one of the remaining animals, use some of its cells, and then make a clone population from that. Now, the tricky thing there is that would require using what's called adult cells. Mm-hmm. So that's not what has been done with this latest development, which utilized fetal cells. When these same Chinese researchers tried to work with adult cells, they were not successful at getting a pregnancy that was brought to term and resulted in healthy offspring. So there would need to be several more advancements before that happened. But the idea is exciting because you would, in theory, only need a small population of donor cells and surrogate mothers to make this process go forward. You'd still have concerns about genetic diversity for obvious reasons, but when you're talking about creatures where there might just be a few left, there's excitement.
We're talking with Dina Fine-Marin right now. She's the health and medicine editor at Scientific American, and we are taking a look at the news that there have been monkeys cloned using a new technology. And Dina, as you just referenced, this breakthrough happened in China. How do laws around primate research in the U.S. affect the possibility for similar work happening here?
There is a certain reticence about doing testing on chimpanzees right now in particular, although primate research in general has a lot of strict guidelines in the United States and the Europe and elsewhere. In the United States right now, there's no longer government funding supply for doing research on chimpanzees, and the chimpanzee testing population is slowly being retired. So the extent to which primate research would continue in the United States and use this cloning technology remains an open question.
And this breakthrough has happened, and they know how they were able to do it when it had not been successful before. But from what I've been reading, it doesn't sound like suddenly there are going to be hundreds or even dozens of cloned monkeys showing up. What kind of process happens now that the technology has been established? You know, what kind of numbers might we be talking about?
One researcher I spoke to said that we are at a place technology-wise right now where, in theory, in the near future, they could adjust their methods slightly to create dozens of clones in the near future. I don't know if that will really happen. I do think that there will need to be several more technological advances. For example, even though this research team in China did manage to get these two healthy macaque monkeys, you've probably seen the pictures circulating, they are very cute,
they are.
Is that that success rate was really low in the single digits. Though they tried to make this process work more than 100 times, there were only these two offspring that were born, so that's something to think about. The other point that we really should make is that human clones are definitely not around the corner from this technology, and that's for two reasons. One was this is only successful with this technique when they used fetal cells, cells from aborted fetuses, which means this is not what we'd be dealing with people anytime soon. But the second one is this really low success rate I'm talking about now. That's not something that any ethicist or scientific team would want to move forward with in humans.
Is there any kind of half measure where maybe not cloning an entire primate, whether human or non-human, but does this technology have any applications to be able to create some, I'm out of my depth here, but some kind of cluster of cells that could be useful in research, but it's not cloning an entire person?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Right now, I do think there are easier technologies that they could utilize for that process, so they wouldn't necessarily go to the trouble to do this. And there are several other cloning techniques that have been established in the last couple of decades that have been used on primate populations, non-human primate populations in the past. And if you just wanted a cell bank, perhaps you would want to look to some of those as well.
It seems also that with advances in gene editing technology, there might be things that we can do through gene editing now that we couldn't before that might be easier and not have the same ethical concerns as cloning an actual human being or non-human primate.
CRISPR technology is certainly moving forward. There have been a lot of advances about being able to make small changes on the cellular level. That's not something that's being used in people right now therapeutically, though that is being tested in lab situations. But if you were trying to study a specific disease in a mouse, for example, yeah, it would be a lot easier to modify one using CRISPR and then try to couple that with cloning technology.
And Dina, as we wrap up, what aspect of this are you most interested in watching as these baby monkeys grow up and the research continues?
I guess it would be twofold. The first is to make sure that this primate population is truly healthy. Other studies that followed previously cloned animals show that they were as healthy as their counterparts who were born through more traditional methods. So that something to watch with the primate population too. And the second one is sort of this short-term question about will they be able to improve their success rates so that they could have better offspring outcomes, more than just the two, let's say having many more of them, and then whether or not they can use adult cells.
Well, Dina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dina Fine-Marin is the health and medicine editor at Scientific American. She talked to Central Times executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about the successful cloning of two baby monkeys and what it could mean for medical research and ethics. A lot of bands get their start by making sounds in their parents' garage. A lot of those bands never make it out of the garage. But in Wisconsin in the 1960s, garage bands were popping up all over the state. One of the state's most successful and long-lasting of those garage bands is Morning Days, who got their start playing teen bars in 1965. They're still making music today. Rick Pfeiffer is in the studio. He's a founding member of Morning Days. He co-authored a new book, Morning Days, a Wisconsin Garage Band. The book chronicles the band's history and evolution over decades of playing bars, getting through lineup changes, and sticking with the dream of playing music. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, how did the band first get started back in the 60s?
It all began, we grew up in Whitewater, Wisconsin, so we had the university there. We had a small band. And in Whitewater, at the beginning of the semesters, the city would open up their streets to all the students. So we thought we would practice that same night that all the students would be downtown. Maybe we'd get some jobs, meet some girls or something. Well, we didn't meet any girls, but we did meet Doug Henry, who was a co-founding member of the band. He came, he heard us play, said, "Hey, you guys need a guitar player?" And we did. And he came, joined the band. From there, we met our drummer. And that group was together for almost 5 years.
And one of the stories I love is early on, I don't know if you're still in high school at this point.
I'm in high school, sophomore.
You got a special long hair exemption because of your job as a musician.
My job as a musician. Wasn't that pretty? Yeah, it was
great.
How'd
that happen?
Well, we had played up in the Dells, and we met some people there who wanted us to go out to Brown University and open up for the Supremes. And we felt we needed to have our look in order to keep the job, which was having long hair. So we went to the school, and they had told me I couldn't go to school with long hair. But we asked them, "Hey, we're playing in a band. We really need it for our job. Let me grow, keep my hair long just for this gig, and then I'll cut it again." And they were cool with that and said, yeah. That'd be okay.
But you found out afterwards there'd been some secret behind-the-scenes intervention, right? Years later, you found this out.
All kinds of behind-the-scenes things. Yeah, I had no idea that my mother went to the my mother went to the principal with a checkbook saying, "Here, this is the way my son's making his living. You can't cut him off from a source of income," which is pretty cool.
And in the book, you really highlight your parents and some of the other parents of band members through the years as people who made it happen, in part by letting you use the garage, fronting you maybe some equipment, yeah, some money for an amp.
Yeah, yeah. And in those days, you had to co-sign for equipment. You just couldn't go out and borrow money. You had to actually have somebody co-sign it for you. And our parents stood beside us as far as co-signing was concerned, supported us, gave us places to stay when we needed... some nights we'd be coming home at Saturday nights with 14, 15 people in the entourage. They'd all stay at my parents' house. My mom would feed them. She'd do their laundry. But they were always there for us through thick and thin.
Now, we heard a little clip of music there. Was that from the early years in the 60s?
That was from the early years, yeah. That was from 1967, a record that we recorded down in Chicago on Kiderian Records.
And that sounded a little psychedelic. Is that how you describe some of your early stuff?
Yeah, there was a song called Ichiku Park that kind of featured some phase shifting, which really hadn't been heard
a lot of.
Yeah, so, and these guys in the studio down there, they wanted to play with that and tinker with it, and they thought it'd be kind of cool to use it on our tune, which they did.
And so these young guys, you're getting gigs. What kind of places were you playing?
Oh, back then, because there were so many teen bars in Wisconsin, there were places... And every teen bar had a band. If you're going to be successful as a teen bar, you needed a band. So we worked a lot through Ken Adamany, who was just getting his start out of Janesville. And we played all the major universities. We were playing teen clubs. We were playing frat parties. We were all over the place. We were doing opening acts. We were an opening act for many people. And we travel a lot.
I should ask about the name, Morning Days, and since this is radio, I'm going to spell it. It's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, and Days is D-A-Y-Z-E. And there's a story, a vehicle that was part of that name.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we had traveled so many, we traveled a lot. We were often on the road. We were coming home early in the morning looking for a new name. Before Morning Days, we were called The Coachman, and we needed something new, so we named ourselves Morning Days for no particular reason other than it was morning and we were all in a daze. But we also had a hearse, and we thought that the spelling of Morning Days would kind of match our hearse really well. And our Doug Henry picked up, saw this hearse in Hales Corners, Milwaukee. We bought it for $500, put over 100,000 miles on it.
This was your band van.
It was a hearse. A band hearse, yeah, with trailer, which was cool. You saw us coming, and people knew us when we were coming into town.
I want to give a listen to a song that you got some radio play with. This is a little bit of Fly My Paper Airplane. And so this song got some radio play. How did it make it there? Why was this one the one that made it?
We were working through a record company out of Chicago that had connections with WCFL. And at that time, Dick Biondi and Joel Sebastian were working at the radio station down there. And so they were trying to promote our record. And it got played on WLS, I think maybe once. But we at that time, WLS and CFL were doing a lot of afternoon in the park shows that with multiple bands. And we were one of the opening acts. And one day we were down there, a CTA, before they were Chicago, was the headliner down there.
Well, Chicago Transit Authority, the band that became Chicago. Gotcha.
Yes. So, those kind of shows is what we were doing to promote our record. And we were number 9 in Davenport, Iowa, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, it's getting up there. Climbing those charts.
Talking to Rick Pfeiffer from the band Morning Days. They've been at it over 50 years. There's a new book, A Wisconsin Garage Band, rocking since 1965. You got online in 2004, and you thought, like a lot of people, I'm going to look at my band name and find out what's going on. And there was that song we just heard, Fly My Paper Airplane, had a bit of a resurgence.
Yes, it had been re-released by a company called Gear Fab Records. They put it on a CD called Illinois Psychedelic States. They had no idea that we were from Wisconsin, just that we recorded in Illinois. They re-released it and had been getting airplay throughout the country on college garage rock stations, grunge rock stations. And so we contacted them and developed a relationship with them, and they've been doing real well, selling that crazy album.
There's a lot of history we're going to fast forward through. You spent a lot of time, you were a house band at Alpine Valley for a long time.
We were, yeah. We were a house band at Alpine Valley for 28 years. We were the house band there 10 years before the music theater came. It was primarily just a ski resort. And we would be playing there Monday through Sunday and Sunday afternoons to packed houses every night. We did work with WTMJ Radio out of Milwaukee with their shows. And later on, we worked with WGN, Bob Collins, out of Chicago, when they came up and did Ski Sprees. And then the amphitheater came, and we had all these major acts coming into Alpine. The first year they were there, the manager of Alpine wanted us to open up. He said, God, you guys have to make it. And Boz Scaggs was opening up, and they wouldn't put us on as the opening act because we didn't have any albums. Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes bumped us out. But we met so many acts out there, so many stage crews, and just had a great time talking to them all.
I want to listen to another track. This one, I think, is a more recent song from you. Here's a listen.
All right.
This is you on solo guitar.
It's a song I wrote. Yes.
Now, there's a lot of guys out there, Rick, who had that garage band in the 60s, and they're thinking, glory days, those are good times. Yeah. You never stopped. Can you talk about what you're performing now when you're out playing? Okay.
Yeah, as a group, we're doing a nice mix of Motown, soul, reggae. We're doing some Cajun music and some pop. But it's all music that we're really trying to share with our audience. You know, it's a love that we have for what we're doing with our audience. We're trying to give them a big hug, you know, and really not play at them, but play for them, play with them, and try to get them dancing, having a good time.
I understand. I might hear, if I go see you, a Bruno Mars cover, an Adele cover. You're not playing oldies. Or not only oldies.
Not only oldies, yeah, because my sister sings that Adele and Bruno stuff, but she really loves that music and sings it like she loves it. So it's different than just going out, well, we're going to play these tunes because they're pop and we have to do them. She really enjoys doing it and always has, and she's terrific.
Now, I was I got my hair cut by a young guy. He's just started singing and producing his own stuff. Yeah. He just started in the last year. If there are younger folks out there listening, what would you tell them as they're starting maybe a musical career now, musical journey now?
You have to play where your roots are at. You can't be something that you're not. You have to sort of discover what you are. You have to experiment a little bit, but you really have to find out what you may want to be something, but you may be something completely different, and you have to find out where your soul is in your music. And I would play from your soul rather than from your head what you think you should be playing.
And now real quick, there's this book I'm holding here, there's a DVD attached. What's it like to look back at that span since the 60s?
It's amazing. None of us can believe how fast it's gone by. Our audience is still huge, and we look at it, how much of an impact we've made on other people's lives that we don't even realize. We've had some book signings and book tours, and talking about garage bands with people just brings up this wonderful conversation about how music connects people, and that's been a wonderful thing to share.
It's been a lot of fun talking to you, Rick. Thanks so much for coming up.
Thank you, Rob. Enjoyed it very much.
That's Rick Pfeiffer, founding member of the band Morning Days, co-author of the book Morning Days, a Wisconsin Garage Band. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Now, in President Trump's first State of the Union address this week, he called on both parties to come together on a plan for safe, fast, reliable, and modern infrastructure, and to produce a bill to generate at least $1.5 trillion for new infrastructure investment.
We will build gleaming new roads, bridges, highways, railways, and waterways all across our land. And we will do it with American heart and American hands and American grit.
Well, what's ahead for the plan and what roadblocks would need to be addressed? Brianna Gerchlow is a transportation reporter for Politico Pro. Brianna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Rocky Moretti is with us, Director of Policy and Research at the National Transportation Research Group, TRIP. Rocky, welcome to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me on the show.
Brianna, let's start with some of the basics. The president talking about trying to generate $1.5 trillion for infrastructure investment. That doesn't mean the federal government spending $1.5 trillion, right?
That's right. What the administration is expected to propose is actually $200 billion in federal spending.
And where would the other, $1.3 trillion come from then?
That would be spending by state and local governments, as well as spending, in theory, by private investors as well.
And Rocky, can you talk about the state of our nation's infrastructure? What are the needs we have? How extensive are they?
Well, if you look across the country, around a third of major roads, urban roads, have pavements in poor condition. Around one out of every 10 bridges is structurally deficient. We're seeing traffic congestion increasing, particularly in the last 3 years. Vehicle travel since 2013 is up approximately 10% across the country, and that's a good economic sign. The country clearly is seeing a lot of economic growth, but the quality of the infrastructure has a huge impact on the quality of economic growth and also the ability of states to attract growth. And so, you know, we're pleased to see the president so prominently promoting that need for infrastructure, but I think as Brianna has alluded, the real challenge is where all of that additional money is going to come from.
And does that worry you, Rocky, for this plan coming into existence, for this money actually to end up being spent?
Well, if you look at, for example, what's happened over the last 5 years, what we've seen is approximately half of the states have approved significant increases in funding, usually by increasing user fees, usually fuel taxes or registration fees. And it was a recognition that with this tremendous growing infrastructure challenge, that states would need to do a lot more to increase those revenues. So you've got those states that have increased the revenues, and unfortunately, in this case, Wisconsin, which really over the last decade at least has not shown an appetite for significant increases in transportation funding. And so that's going to be the challenge, is crafting by Congress a bill that really incentivizes, but how are the other states going to respond to this call for increased funding?
We'll dig a little more into Wisconsin in a bit, but Brianna, you and your team at Politico put together a timeline on President Trump and his administration when it comes to talking about infrastructure. He's been focusing on this theme, or at least talking about this theme, for some time, but not much has happened. Can you give us a little bit of the backstory there?
Sure. So the president has been talking about infrastructure since he was campaigning. During the campaign, Hillary Clinton proposed spending $275 billion on infrastructure, and I believe it was 2016 in the summer. He said that he wanted to have a plan that was twice as large, so something like $550 billion. And it wasn't entirely clear how that would be paid for. It seems that he was suggesting that it would be paid for through debt. Later in the fall, leading up to the election, he released a 100-day action plan, and that included a proposal for a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, and that seemed to be focused more on tax incentives and public-private partnerships. After he was elected, the plan was kind of pushed behind healthcare and tax reform, and there was some talk of possibly tying tax reform and infrastructure together, but it didn't happen. As we all know, the tax reform bill passed in December, and now there's talk in Washington of this being the next big item on the agenda, some drips and dribbles about the administration's infrastructure plan has come out. In the meantime, what we know is that that $200 billion, one part of it, half of it, we believe, is going to go toward an incentive program for state and local governments. A quarter of it is going to go to rural infrastructure in the form of block grants. And another part of it will be for transformational or transformative projects. And another part would go to existing loan programs.
We're talking about infrastructure after President Trump brought it up as an issue, as a priority in his State of the Union address. Brianna Gerchlo is with us from Politico, and Rocky Moretti from the Transportation Research Group, TRIP. So, Rocky, is the money out there? If these incentives are out there, are state and local governments and maybe private businesses going to pick it up and run with it to where we get to something like $1.5 trillion?
Well, you're really going to have to look at that one state at a time. And so, as I've said, around half of the states in the last 5 years have moved forward with significant transportation funding bills. A number of states this year are also, again, looking at increasing their funding. But that would be the challenge. You know, as I've said, in Wisconsin, there hasn't been at the state level a boost in either fuel or registration fees, at least since 2006. And, of course, the bill also talks about promoting large infrastructure bills or large highway or bridge projects, and typically those need a revenue stream which involves tolling. And again, Wisconsin is a state where there hasn't been a movement towards tolling. So it's really a program that says that if states are willing to help themselves, we'll help them, and that's going to be the challenge to Wisconsin and other states.
And Rocky, if you've been watching, you know that transportation has been a big stumbling block in Wisconsin's overall state budget. Two budgets in a row now. The governor today saying he would be open maybe to a gas tax increase if it's offset by decreases in other taxes. This is some of the same debate we've seen over the last few years. Do you think that this kind of infrastructure incentive will successfully incentivize a state like Wisconsin to do something like that?
Well, if you look at Wisconsin, where some major projects like a portion of the I-94 East-West project and a part of the work on the north leg of the Zoo Interchange have been set aside in recent years. And just if you look in the news, since the first of the year, the Madison Beltline has been closed down three times because of buckling of the highways. Obviously, there's significant need to upgrade the infrastructure in the state. And so there's certainly significant incentive. And ultimately, if Congress, through the House and the Senate, craft a bill with these types of incentives, then hopefully that will help states move forward and go ahead and put this funding in place.
And Brianna, getting to the politics of this, some people from both sides of the aisle have said, hey, maybe infrastructure is the place. We're going to disagree on immigration, all this other stuff. Maybe we can work together on infrastructure. Do you see signs that that might actually happen?
Well, when I talk to lawmakers, they do see infrastructure as an area where there can be bipartisan cooperation. But then things start to break down when they talk about paying for it and paying for the federal share. So far, the administration has only suggested that $200 billion be paid for by cuts to other areas of the federal budget. They've said that they are open to other pay-fors, but they're really looking to Congress to come up with those, and it being kind of a process of the White House, the Senate, the House working together on coming up with pay-fors. But that's really where the tension comes politically, is how they are going to cover that spending.
And Rocky, that all involves Congress taking action in the year now of the Trump administration. Have you seen any kind of executive action that you see helping or hurting the infrastructure situation?
Well, you know, the challenge, you know, one of the biggest challenges over the last several years with infrastructure investment, at least for surface transportation, has been a lack of adequate funding in the Highway Trust Fund. And so Congress has topped that up with about a third of the funding coming from general fund sources. And there's been a tremendous a desire within the transportation community to see that trust fund made whole by coming up with adequate resources and adequate funding. So that would be a logical first step for Congress at starting to look at the Trump infrastructure proposals, is to work through the existing trust fund mechanism.
We are talking about infrastructure spending in the United States, our roads, bridges, and more. President Trump brought it up in the State of the Union, hoping to get some federal spending to be an incentive for state and local spending as well. We have Brianna Gurciulo with us and Rocky Moretti. We're digging into the president's proposal, what we know about it, what its prospects are. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. National or local level, what are the infrastructure challenges your local community faces? Do you want to see this as a priority for the federal government, for the state government, for that matter? Do you think that Republicans and Democrats can and or should work together on something like this, on making roads and other infrastructure a priority? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. We'll go to your calls now. We've got Jeff on the line in Lauren, Illinois. Jeff, hi.
Hi there. Hey, I heard a study, this was years ago, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, about a particular bridge that had a lot of potholes in it. And someone monitored the bridge by video 24/7, and they added up the amount of cars that got stuck on the bridge because of the potholes. They added up the towing, they added up the repair, they added up the traffic slowdown, and they figured out that if somebody would have fixed the bridge, it would have paid for itself after 2 years. So my point is, you're paying for this infrastructure one way or another. You can't escape it. It sounds like it's a huge expense coming out of nowhere, but it's something that you're paying for on your vehicles anyway, no matter what happens.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Rocky, are we there? We're having enough economic damage from faulty roads and other infrastructure that it's more than it would be, or as much as it would be, to fix it?
Well, we were in Wisconsin in 2016 doing a report, and we looked at what's the cost of motorists of getting their cars beat up by rough roads, what's the cost of the travel delays to the public, and what's the cost of the economic cost of serious traffic crashes. And we estimated that cost was $6 billion annually in Wisconsin and approximately $2,000 a year for the average motorist in Madison. So the caller is quite correct. As we know in our own lives with our own homes or anything that we're maintaining, that if you don't make the repairs, if you don't make the improvements, you're just going to pay that much more.
Thanks a lot for the call. And Brianna, with where the money is coming from, is there any kind of talk of an increase to the federal gas tax to cover part of the costs here?
Yes. Just today at the GOP retreat in West Virginia, Congressman Bill Schuster, he's a Republican from Pennsylvania and the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, he said he himself brought up the gas tax at a meeting with Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, with National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, and GOP lawmakers. And he said that this is something that Congress should consider, raising the gas tax. He wasn't very specific on how much he would support. He threw out the number 15 cents in an interview later with Bloomberg. So he has very much said that that is on the table for him.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is on the line in Medford. Jim, hi. There we go.
Question,
Jim, hi.
Question for Rocky. Out of the states that have passed revenue increases in the last few years, are the traditional ones such as fuel tax, registration, sales tax, tolls, and how about vehicle mile travel?
Jim, thanks for the call. So, Rocky, for states that have dealt with this, the line is a little hard to hear there. What kind of revenue increases have they done?
Looking back to 2013, so over the last 5 years, in the 25 states that have increased funding for transportation, almost all of them included an increase in user fees for in terms of fuel taxes, and about half of them had boost in registration fees. So those were the two most common. Certainly there were other mechanisms of maybe moving some general funds over. We're starting to see increasingly states are also making sure that there's a tax or an annual fee on ownership of electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles. And that kind of brings to the caller's last point, which is a good one, which is obviously the interest in looking at some way of having what people pay tied in with how much they're driving. And that would lead towards some sort of user fee. Obviously, the big stumbling block was how to do it and how to protect people's privacy. And several states in Oregon and now California are taking the lead on working through that mechanism. And so I think that down the road that is probably going to be a good way to look at it, because people do recognize the fairness of the more you use the system, the more you pay into it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. And Brianna, getting back to Congress, are members of Congress feeling the heat from governors around the state and state legislatures saying, we've got these problems here, we need some kind of help, participation from the federal government?
I would say so, yes. They've definitely brought this up, and I think lawmakers are taking that into consideration. Both parties as well, both Republicans and Democrats, hearing from governors, from local officials, saying that they've already raised their gas taxes, and what they really need is federal money.
Let's go back to our callers. Darren is with us in Green Bay. Darren, hi.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I was just going to say that, Wisconsin is really in dire need of, improvements to the roads and bridges. You had in Green Bay, you had the Leo Frigo Bridge that sank about 6 to 8 inches just a few years ago. State Highway 54, being a state highway, you can't even drive the speed limit on it east of Black River Falls because it's so bumpy and torn up. And I don't know where all this money is going to come from with all of these quote-unquote tax reform or tax cuts for the wealthy, which is where most of our taxes come from in this country.
Darren, thanks a lot for the call. Rocky, how do we stack up in Wisconsin? I mean, I assume everybody kind of perceives their roads as uniquely bad. Are we in particularly rough shape here in the state?
The challenge in Wisconsin is initially one of preservation. You've got a high share, about 40% of the state's roads and highways have pavements in either poor or mediocre condition. And like the rest of the country, about 1 in 10 of every bridge is structurally deficient. But the challenge in Wisconsin and really across the country is there's also the need for some additional capacity, certainly in the metro areas, but even some of the other interstates that serve tourism. But the challenge is as these bridges, these heavily traveled bridges and highways age, as you would anticipate, it becomes that much more expensive to make those repairs. And so Wisconsin has an aging system of older bridges carrying significant volumes, and the transportation agencies do the best they can within their resources. But to really start to plan out the long-term reconstruction, replacement of these facilities are really quite expensive, and that's the challenge states are falling into. Their economies rest and ride on those systems, but they're coming to a point where significant investment is going to be due.
I want to bring on one more caller. Devery is with us in Madison. Hi.
Hi. One quick comment and then a question. The quick comment is, yes, I'd love to see the Democrats and the Republicans work together on anything, whether it's transportation or something else. But the question is, how would it be determined what projects these funds would go to? For instance, like here in Madison, 6 or 7 years ago, during the Obama administration, we had all those federal tax dollars that were coming in that was supposed to provide more jobs and be used for these big projects. And here in Madison, we were in year two of redoing all of University Avenue, and instead they just took those tax dollars and put it to that. We didn't see any increase in jobs, and it got wasted, in my opinion.
Devery, I want to jump in because we're almost out of time. Brianna, do we have a sense of if this plan came to fruition, how priorities would be set on what kind of projects, which projects would be funded, just briefly?
Well, how I've heard it described is that the administration will be agnostic in terms of mode. You know, it could go to roads, bridges, tunnels, but it could also go to airports, it could go to waterways, it could go to projects with the electrical grid, it could go to broadband. So the kind of infrastructure isn't so much important. It's what's being weighed is more of the how much that state and local governments are willing to raise themselves. And of course, it's different for, say, a rural project where, you know, something like a public-private partnership may not work. Then that would be more of a block grant.
Brianna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rocky, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Brianna Gruccolo, a transportation reporter for Politico Pro, and Rocky Moretti. He directs policy and research at TRIP. They looked at what's known and unknown about the Trump administration's infrastructure proposal and some of the infrastructure needs around the country and here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll visit Puerto Rico to get the latest on recovery efforts still ongoing from last year's hurricane season. We'll find out how the helpful bacteria and other stuff that lives in our gut can impact our health and, apparently, our athletic performance, if any. And on Food Friday, we'll get some recipes for great snacks and dips just in time for our Super Bowl party. You can get a head start. Let us know what you are planning to serve and or eat. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.